welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. My name is Peter Liu. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and I'm joined today by my favorite co-host, Dr. Jennifer Lee.
You say that for everyone.
But this time I mean it.
Okay. But, hey, you just got back from Florida.
I did. Well, I mean, it's a couple of weeks ago, but yes, yeah. I was at that Pete's GI Connect conference.
Yeah, how was it?
Hollywood. It was awesome. First of all, as many of you know, that's the same hotel as where NASPGHAN's going to be this year.
Yeah.
And where NASPGHAN was like, you know, I think it was like 8 years ago, seven, 8 years ago, where there's a karaoke bar in the lobby.
That was one of your favorite NASPGHAN memories, wasn't it?
Yeah, Miguel Sapp singing Despacito. Oh, that's awesome. Okay. And so the hotel is incredible, great location. I am super pumped to go back for NASPGHAN for a little bit longer. I brought Leslie and Emma, which probably won't bring them next time, but it was fine. It was just like...
Probably too cold to go to the ocean.
No, it was nice weather, but it was also just like... Emma won't nap. And I'm like, oh, I'm like in the middle of a session. Like, what am I supposed to do? You know, that kind of stuff.
That is hard. Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it was awesome. And it's a little bit smaller. So like, I feel like usually I only attend motility talks, but I went to a pancreas talk for the first time in like a decade.
So you probably learned so much.
I know slightly more about the pancreas than I did before. So there's
But wait, the hotel is not small though. So we don't have to worry about, okay, just the conference itself is small.
Well, I mean, it's just smaller than NASPGHAN. Gotcha. You know, it's like probably a couple hundred people.
Yeah, definitely worth looking into next year. And everyone's probably getting their abstracts ready because the submissions are coming up in a couple months.
June 6th, I believe.
Yeah, and don't forget about Baby Shark Tank.
Not a couple weeks, a couple months.
Whatever.
You're going to start months. Anxiety for people. month and a half as of the release of this episode.
Okay. Well, there's one other thing I think is important that we need to mention today. Okay. And that is that one of our mentors here at Nationwide Children's is retiring tonight.
Former Bowel Sounds guest.
Yes. Everyone go back and listen to his episode on polyposis. Mm-hmm. Steve Erdman. Yeah. His retirement party's tonight.
I know.
We are wearing fanny packs.
A lot of buzz in the division.
I know. I wonder if he's finally going to show us what's in his
fanny pack.
Yes.
So for the audience, he has for decades worn a fanny pack around his waist, slung to the back. No one has any idea what's in there.
Yep.
A lot of guesses. Probably G-tube supplies, but maybe also some alcohol, maybe a little liquor bottle.
Hopefully not that one.
Yeah. Well, who knows?
Who knows? Maybe he'll show us tonight.
Probably not. Compass. I think a compass for sure. But yes, so like we are all planning on bringing our own fanny packs.
Why do you need a compass in the hospital?
That makes no sense. Oh, come on. There was one time when another fellow asked him like, hey, because he loves the outdoors, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like, what's your favorite national park? And he was like, Ryan, the better question is, what's my favorite national wilderness? It's like, dude, wow. Like,
that's really cool.
We're not even the same level.
Yeah. I'm following him on Strava, so I'm really looking forward to his hikes that are about to come up.
It's like a hiking app that tracks your location.
Okay. Strava will have to be a topic for another conversation.
It's like a running thing.
Yes.
Oh, God.
But there's hikes on there.
Huh.
Yeah. Anyway, everyone follow Steve Erdman on Strava. So today we have a really, really cool topic.
Oh, so good.
And we did it in person. Even better.
We did it in person. Yes. So Dr. Mike Wilsey, he happened to be coming to Columbus and we said, we need to talk to you.
Yeah. About dilating the esophagus.
I mean, I feel like esophageal strictures, it's something that we maybe not encounter like every single day, but we all encounter it with some regularity.
Oh yeah.
And with EOE increasing, that kind of stuff. It's a thing. We got to know what to do.
Yeah.
So we decided to talk to him. So he has a lot of stuff going on.
Okay. You know? Try to get it right.
I mean, it's gonna be tough. Because he works for a private practice in St. Petersburg, Florida, Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition of Florida. He also works at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. He's a professor at the University of South Florida, and he's held so many leadership positions in these organizations. Mm-hmm. He's been a big deal in NASPGHAN as well, and such a nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
And so he was the perfect person for us to snag for a few hours and talk to him about strictures.
Yes, it's a great episode. Really looking forward to sharing it with everyone. On to the show.
On to the show. Dr. Wilsey, thank you so much for joining us on Bowel Sounds today. It's an honor to have you come in person. to my office recording studio. We're so excited to have you here.
Thanks. It's a real honor to be here. And it's been such an engaging morning. I'm really looking forward to spending some time together.
Awesome. So yes, so we got wind of Dr. Wilsey coming to visit Columbus, Ohio. We're like, we need to sit down with him. So he gave our division a talk this morning. And so now we get to talk more about a topic. I feel like it's going to be a very popular topic because I feel like there's so many nuances to dealing with esophageal strictures that we don't always get a ton of training on when we're in fellowship. So we want to talk to the guru.
Yes. Especially since we've been seeing more and more of them, I feel like.
UE and stuff.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's start with one of the challenging questions just to get it out of the way. How would you describe yourself in one sentence?
One sentence. Thank you, Jen. Well, if I were to describe myself in one sentence, I'd say I'm an enthusiastic pediatric gastroenterologist, passionate about advanced endoscopy and mentoring the next generation, an avid runner and marathon enthusiast who has been happily married to my beautiful wife, Adriana, for over 30 years, wow. And the proud father of three amazing and remarkable young adult children.
Awesome.
I love that.
That was good. So of course, like around St. Petersburg area, there's so much to do. Siesta Key, Sarasota, Tampa.
Yes.
But for the visitor who may not be super familiar with the area, what are things you recommend that they have to do that may not be super obvious, like lying on the beach all day?
Great question. Yeah, the whole Tampa Bay metropolitan area, yeah, like you said, it's on the west coast of Florida, Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater, and Sarasota. You know, and Tampa, you know, has Busch Gardens, so it has adventure, has the Riverwalk, which is fantastic, all along the Hillsborough River, and you have Armature Works at one end, and Sparkman's Wharf, which is where the cruise ships dock. And you may remember during the pandemic, and everything was shut down, but the Buccaneers won a Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And so they couldn't have a parade downtown to celebrate because of social distancing. And so we had a boat parade through the Riverwalk. And you may have remembered a slightly tipsy Tom Brady tossing the Lombardi Trophy to another teammate in another boat. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, it did not sink to the bottom of the river.
You know,
Cameron Brake caught it and made the news. And also the Lightning, which played downtown right by Sparkman's Wharf. They won back-to-back Stanley Cup championships. And again, couldn't have it. And so the river was fantastic. So I think Riverwalk in Tampa, and of course there's other activities. But if you're in St. Pete, you know, has the waterfront, has the iconic pier. There's parks and restaurants, and a lot of journalists are calling St. Pete, I'm not sure if you're aware, the next Austin, Texas. Because it's quirky, it's weird, it's up and coming. There's a music and art scene. And I read in one article, sans, you know, 60,000 college students, right? If you get a chance to look that up, you know, Clearwater has its own, and Sarasota. But I think if you're going to do the one thing, I think you have to visit the white sand beaches of the Gulf Coast. Yeah. And there's over 800 miles of beaches in Florida. And so whatever's closest, it's just peaceful and tropical.
Oh, man. Why are we doing this one in Columbus?
Like, we should have gone down there.
I always thought Columbus was the next Austin, but I guess it's I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Well,
we have a river.
We've had great restaurants.
And we have great restaurants. We have a hockey team.
So speaking of our beloved Columbus Blue Jackets, we have not won anything.
I know.
But there was one series, playoff series, against the Lightning where no one thought we'd ever win, and we won.
So good.
I think that was in 2018 or something. It's the highlight of the Columbus Blue Jackets, winning one first round playoff series. So
it counts.
So anyways, in your one liner, you talked about how you're enthusiastic about endoscopy. Yes. So can you tell us how you first developed this interest?
Thanks. I appreciate that. I remember when I was a medical student, I went and did a rotation out at Texas Children's Hospital. And Mark Gilger was one of the attendings. And he said, endoscopy, you know, it's like being a quasi-surgeon. It's the only way you can examine an organ from the inside without surgery. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. And so they did a rotation. And if you were a third-year fellow on the clinic, if you're on the NIH grant, you could. But if you're on the clinical path, you could spend a month or two as what they called it, pretendings, which there were reins, and there was no fellow. And so Johanna Altawil, who's now in Knoxville, Texas, in Tennessee rather, was the pretending that month. And I was elevated from fourth year medical student to fellow. He's like, listen, boss, go around on all the patients, write all the notes. I have clinic. And in the afternoon, I have three cases and I'll let you do them. And so he taught me endoscopy as a medical student, and I just loved it. I loved the hands-on approach. I loved the intervention. I loved making a difference. Like, you can do stuff. As a first year fellow, I did research at the VA, and we had research electives, and David Graham was the head of the VA. He invented the urea breath test. And so I wanted to do some clinical research, because everything back then was basic science, and that was really the format and the foundation that was available. So it sort of carved out a niche for clinical research. And so we ended up doing H. pylori testing in children. We used the breath tests and others. But while I was there, I befriended all the fellows. And it was interesting. One of the fellows came back from a ski trip and tore his ACL. And so the wait list was 3 or 6 months, and they're like, hey, can you help out? So I was doing VA colonoscopies. Oh, wow. That really helped skill set. And then I remember one day they're like, hey, we'll see. Come down to the endo suite. We've got this prototype mother-daughter ERCP scope. Hmm. It was the first prototype for the spyglass. So where you put the scope into the bile duct and then put a little baby, back then it was just a bronchoscope, through the ERCP scope into, and to look at for cholangiocarcinoma and for stone disease. I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is so fantastic. I love this. But back then there weren't, and others have talked about it on the podcast, about how do you become an advanced endoscopist? Mm-hmm. Well, you just have to make time. And so I met with the ERCP, the advanced endoscopist, and said, hey, I'd like to do it. And it's like, yeah, you and everybody else, because there's other third year fellows. So I made friends with them, and we sort of split cases. Yeah. And of course the quid pro quo is the attending said, well, if you're going to come do my cases, you need to come to clinic and help me out with patients. And so I was the third year fellow at Baylor, and of course doing research and doing all that, and then hoofing it over to do adult GI clinic to see 90-year-olds and stuff. That it was just, it wasn't that far from training, but it seemed like a long time. But it was just such great experience, and I thought, I want to do this. But I knew, you know, if the why is strong enough, you'll figure out the how, right? Mm-hmm. And I knew why I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. I just had to figure out how to do it, and just believe that I could do it. And that helped propel, because everyone's going to tell you no. Too hard, too much. You're already working so much. Now, how are you going to learn these extra skills? But if your why is strong enough, you can figure out the how.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before. And I actually really love that sentence. If the why is strong enough, you'll figure out the how.
100%.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. The other thing that I think is a little bit unique is, you know, for me and Jen, we've only ever worked at like this big academic hospital.
Yeah.
But looking through some of your bios, it's like you do a lot of roles, right? And then there's some aspects of your career that have been in private practice and at, you know, Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital and also at USF. And can you tell us about what does your day-to-day look like now in terms of like, you know, clinic, teaching, academic stuff or procedures?
Right, right. No, thanks. Yeah, when I came to Texas Children's and just, I loved it. I loved the culture. I loved the small town feel of living in Houston. And we loved our neighbors. They were friends like family. And then we just had a life-changing event. We thought about staying at fellowship, after fellowship. And then my wife's father passed away unexpectedly, 53. I'll be 55 this year, so a little older. And that was a real crux. Like, what are we going to do? Are we going to spend our whole life in here? And the coordinator for our residency program said, Michael, as soon as you can, get as close to home as you can, because you're going to buy a house, fall in love, have kids, join the PTA. And it's better to do that closer if you can. And so I moved back to home. It was like my parents were there, and the hospital, All Children's Hospital, was 2 miles away from my parents' house.
Yeah.
And my mom was active and she volunteered at the hospital. So we were, and it's the community, it's the hometown thing. And it was a small group then. I think it was 4 docs at the time, and went from the largest children's hospital, 20 stories, to a 3-story community hospital. But they had a residency program, USF. And my wife and I went to USF undergrad. We're college sweethearts. Yeah, it's a great story. You know, she was a freshman and she dumped her boyfriend. And I swooped in, got her off the
waiting
rebound.
In the wings.
Oh, yes, right, exactly. I definitely married up. So we married. It'll be 32 years in May.
Wow.
And so we loved the university, and you know, we're supporters of the athletic program. And I got involved with USF, the pediatric residency program. And I loved working with the residents, loved the medical students, and serving as the GI clerkship coordinator. And so after that, after a while, you got to go to all the events, graduation and others. And Val Panzerino was the residency director. She asked if I'd serve as the associate residency director to help integrate her. I said, absolutely. Marty Lauren was my residency director at Texas Children's Hospital, one of my mentors and just an idol. I really looked up to him. And I thought, I'd love to do what he does, helping young people. Just he said he had his door open all the time. time. He said, you're always welcome to come in at any time. Please. And I love that accessibility. And so I served for a few years until Val stepped down from the position. And but it was just a terrific experience that I enjoyed. And so involved with the residents and then all children's, you know, still in private practice. And it used to be about 50-50 with the medical staff and because of the community hospital. And it's growing into an academic institution. They partnered with Johns Hopkins Medical School in 2011 then started a second residency program. It's like other hospitals, so there's two residency programs. Yeah. I serve as clinical clerkship coordinator for both and working with both residents. And it's just been a privilege. Like young people, like, I love GI. And they're like, what do you love about GI?
Yeah.
Well, I love doing procedures. I love being an expert in one particular field. I love the breadth and the pediatric gastroenterology. I love making a difference in the life of children. You know, that is amazing. And to be able to, you know, to help and to see young people say, I want to do that too.
Yeah.
And how can you do it? And my role, especially with the residents, was how do I get into fellowship? You know, especially if it was a smaller program, like scholarship, we need to get you published. And so case reports were sort of the staple. And now 20 years later, scholarship's a part of both residency programs. You know, it's expected. Back when I was in training, you were a rock star if you did scholarship and published outside of all your clinical activities. Now it's expected. And to have seasoned mentors, you know, with projects that are ongoing. So I love that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit specifically about strictures. So we're going to focus on evaluation and management, and we're going to go through three cases that I think really demonstrate clinical scenarios that we all see with some frequency. So let's start with our very first case. So we have a three-year-old girl, complex medical history like prematurity, has cerebral palsy, and a genetic disorder who's never been able to tolerate oral intake. So she was referred to you because she had an esophagram that shows a stricture in the mid-esophagus. And upon reviewing her chart, it looks like she had this stricture even on the upper GI that was performed in the NICU. Mm. So talk us through your thought process about how you would evaluate this child in person and what the next steps may be.
So what a great case. And these are patients usually present with feeding refusal or difficulty with swallow. And that's the question. Is this a congenital or acquired stricture?
Yeah.
Most strictures in pediatrics are acquired. You know, they happen from whether it's a peptic stricture or eosinophilic esophagitis or a caustic ingestion from a battery. Now, there's congenital strictures like an esophageal atresia, whether it's a fibromuscular ring or tracheobronchial remnant or perhaps a web or a diaphragm. Less common, but usually present in this history. And look back, and I love in retrospect, looked at the old study, it was there, even if it was hard to appreciate. So one, what's the cause? Is this an intrinsic cause? Is it an extrinsic cause? Is it coming from the outside? Could this be a vascular ring? Could this be an apparent subclavian artery? And, you know, is it associated with any conditions? Is a patient that has reflux? You know, those strictures tend to be distal, often simple strictures. You know, is this a patient who's just coming to you for the first time? Is there a distant history of, well, did they actually have esophageal atresia repair? Is this an anastomotic stricture? You know, focal strictures, eosinophilic esophagitis tend to be a little more complex. Others, but you know, if there was a family history of atopy, asthma, eczema, seasonal allergic rhinitis, cow smoke allergy as a baby, you know, could it be a mucosal and, you know, such as eosinophilic esophagitis? But, you know, the diagnostic evaluation, detailed history, comprehensive physical examination, really asking for symptoms of dysphagia, aspiration, failure to thrive, feeding refusal, as you've gotten in the history. Advanced imaging, consider an imaging, say, like CT or MRI to look for, you know, tracheal remnant or any cartilage, as well as vascular anomalies, such as extrinsic compression. And then, you know, doing an image study, which you've done, to really look and identify so you can get a length, you can get a location, get a good sense. You know, is this a pinpoint stricture? Is this, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 millimeters? And then next would be an endoscopy to take a look at it. And so when you put the scope in, which I look, you know, where is it located? You know, how many centimeters from the incisors? And what does it look like? Is it a focal simple stricture? Is this a soft stricture? Is this a firm fibrotic? Because sometimes, especially with anastomotic strictures, you'll look at and you'll see like this thick scar band halfway around. And then it's softer on the one side. Well, if you try to dilate that, you're just going to stretch out the soft area. You're not going to break up the scar band. And so those are ones where incisional therapy can be helpful to try to break and disrupt. Because if you're going to dilate, you want – it's like Goldilocks. You know, you want it not too much, not too little, just right. Too much, you're going to perforate. Too little, you're not going to do anything. Right. And if it's, whether it's an inflammatory stricture or congenital stricture, you know, if it's an inflammatory stricture, you don't want to overstretch it because then it's just going to make it angry. Mm. And then uncontrolled, unrelenting inflammation leads to fibrosis and scarring. So it's going to scar back down again. And especially with our kids with esophageal atresia, we really look at pay special attention to the Z line. You know, we use NBI, and sometimes you'll see either a little bit of Barrett's or just an irregular looking Z line. Is the Z line at the level of the diaphragm? You know, is there conjunctiva? Remember, our lower esophageal sphincter, mm-hmm. I don't have to tell you guys, but you know, the diaphragm is so important at really making the lower esophageal sphincter competent. And if it's not, is acid reflux worsening? So sometimes we'll look and we'll have a small hiatal hernia and then distal reflux esophagitis and then a bad refractory stricture. This is a kid who probably is refractory to medical therapy, may need a surgery to help with the reflux. And then once you sort of cool down the constant inflammation, then those strictures tend to be a little more responsive. And then one of the other things too is you can characterize, is this a simple stricture or is this a complex stricture? And what does that mean? You know, if it's a simple stricture, oftentimes you can put the appropriate size scope through. If it's not, this is probably a complex. The length, you know, 2 centimeters, is it small or is it a longer, especially a diffuse stricture, especially with a caustic ingestion? You know, is it irregular? Is it smooth? We talked about that. And then, you know, it helps with prognostication because it's usually simple strictures, 1 to 3 dilations, and it usually fixes it. Some of our kids with esophageal atresia, they'll have an anastomotic stricture, and then they'll have a congenital stricture. And the distal stricture once or twice, and you're usually pretty good. The upper needs a little bit more work, whereas a complex stricture can require 3 or more dilations, and the risk of recurrence is higher. So there's some of the thought processes really describing. So you have to help with both the diagnostic and prognostic, moving forward.
Oh, no, I think that was really helpful. I think one of the things you said early on was about using advanced imaging before we go in for endoscopy. Yeah. So do you have a preference? You mentioned CT and MRI. Is there a specific protocol you like?
You know, for first line, it's usually doing an esophagram. You know, that's helpful. And if you see some external compression, then and age-related, you know, if it's a fast scan CT, then you can do it on 2 or 3. It doesn't require anesthesia, right? That's risk, true. Benefits, and alternatives. So what's the risk of an anesthesia in a young baby versus what's the risk of some low-dose radiation in a fast scan MRI or with contrast? And so weighing those. And also ease and access to care. What can you do?
Gotcha.
Sooner and easier.
Yeah.
Sometimes for our kids, if they travel, you know, from another state to come see us, and we do initial, we'll do a combination case where we'll do a dynamic bronchoscopy and upper endoscopy. And we see, you know, we really want to look at the area. They already have the IV in. We'll just send it out to radiology for a quick CT. That's easy. Yeah. Versus an anesthesia if they're young. Well, I mean, an MRI, then you need to get anesthesia. That's just another layer of complexity.
Gotcha. Yeah. So kind of
so really access to healthcare as well. So the family can get it done that same day.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. I mean, I think you talked about gathering all of that information. And even when we're going into the endoscopy, before you actually just dilate, you really want to better understand what you're dealing with. So I really liked that description. Yep. Because that's really going to guide our management.
100%. And sometimes you don't know what until you get in there. And then really the visual inspection, because there's no perfect modality. You know, sometimes you can miss strictures, especially larger strictures like eosinophilic esophagitis. You know, I think there's a study out that, you know, harder to diagnose strictures 13 millimeters and above if you have, a 9 millimeter scope, because the scope passes easily. And was it just a little under distended or was it a fibrotic thing? And that's where other imaging such as FLIP, you know, and luminal functional lumen imaging, you know, to look at just diameter, compliance, pressure, distensibility, to really get a better idea of how pliable that, that wall is.
And you mentioned before, so, you know, if we do suspect there could be a congenital esophageal stricture, you know, thinking about the type of stricture and specifically like whether there's a tracheobronchial remnant, what's the significance of that?
Yeah. So the challenge is that, you know, especially if you have cartilage in there and if you try to dilate, it could rupture. So you have a risk of dilation. So that's where imaging, and again, there's no 100%. So whether it's CT or MRI, and there's case reports of we tried that, didn't see it. And then, so you can consider if you have the expertise for endoscopic ultrasound. You know, if you have a small probe. Antonio Akiris published a case report of that exact same thing, and where an MRI, CT, couldn't see it, and then did endoscopic ultrasound. And there he was able to see the characteristic cartilagic rings and other structures suggestive of a tracheobronchial remnant. And for that patient, went for surgical management.
And I guess, you know, so we, you know, you kind of went through the differential of esophageal strictures, acquired and congenital. So aside from when there's a suspected or like known tracheobronchial remnant, are there times, like, are there any other scenarios you would have them go to surgery kind of as an initial step, or really aside from that, you know, careful
generally, yeah, exactly, just finding through, you know, that's the risk, yeah, of perforation,
right,
you know, but if you don't find one, you can try, and there are some reports that even with, if there's not a lot of remnant in, yeah, the remnant, you then you can try it as a first line treatment for symptomatic cases, but it's often required that they need surgery, particularly there's a significant amount of aberrant tissue causing obstruction, cartilaginous, and then surgical resection of the affected segment with end-to-end anastomosis might be required.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I think that's important. And actually, one other question I wanted to ask about surgery. So say in this particular case with the three-year-old, you find out, oh, she did have surgery before and we have a surgical anastomosis. Yes. Does that affect, like, give us some of your thought process if that was the situation.
That's something we deal with quite often.
Yeah.
And so what we'll do is an intraoperative esophagram. And so we'll have fluoro in, and then we'll inject contrast. And of course, they're intubated. And then we have anesthesia, put in a suction catheter in the posterior sphincter. And then we inject under pressure to really get a good look of the length. You know, had a recent esophagram, so we'll look at that as well. And to get a better access, is this an anastomotic stricture? Then it's probably fibrotic stricture, unlikely to be a tracheal remnant. And then we really look, is this a soft stricture? Is, mm-hmm, it widely patent? Can we push the scope through easily? Well, then maybe you don't have to do anything about it.
Yeah,
but this is a patient, sure, who's symptomatic. So chances are you may have to do something. And so if it's soft, maybe you can just dilate it. Maybe there's a web, or maybe there's a fibrous band or even a fibrous bridge. In that case, we'll do endoscopic incisional therapy. And so we have using an endocut needle, we'll go ahead, if it's a bridge, which is just scar tissue connecting, and those are so satisfying because all you do is you go and then immediately cut it and then it pops open like a rubber band, and then it's, wow, just widely patent, which is great. Incisional therapy, where it's sort of like doing an episiotomy, right? And so very careful cutting, and you keep going. And so and we'll typically cut Rusty Jennings is one of the premier surgeons. And so he was with me. He's like, Michael, you can cut deeper. You can cut deeper. And it's nice having a surgeon right next to you.
Yeah.
And he says, I love your skill. I said, well, I love your skill. I'm so glad that you're here. You know, and going through the scar tissue. And after, yeah, with time, you know, and being able to go through, this is scar, this is scar, this is scar, this is scar, this is muscle. You know, and getting, yeah, down to the muscular layer. You know, and if you do go too far, then you know, that you can put in like an endoscopic vacuum-assisted closure. And so those that we've done, I would try not to do those. Because
right.
That's way over the side. But some places can. You know, if it's between that and another surgery, uh-huh, you know, can you make it all the way almost through? You know, the Boston group is, you know, shared of those experiences of just cutting until you get almost there. And then you put an evac in there to try to close it.
Wow.
Whew. Yeah, but that's sort of last minute that's salvage, mm-hmm, therapy, endoscopic interventional therapy before going for a big surgery to cut that out and then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I love that. Wow. Yeah. Like these young kids, a little bit more
little
complicated,
babies.
Little,
yeah,
babies, yeah, things we have to think about. Yeah. Peter, do you want to talk a little bit more about what, yeah, we see a little more commonly?
So our second case.
Yes.
Right. So totally different, but mentioned a little bit before. So our second case is a 14-year-old boy admitted for a food impaction. So underwent urgent endoscopic removal. You know, classic story, found to have endoscopic evidence of eosinophilic esophagitis. I feel like for us, it's like if this is done by the surgeons, maybe they don't get any biopsies and just dump it in our lap. But let's say this is done by a GI and they got biopsies. But there's also some narrowing in that distal third of the esophagus where the impaction was. So tell us more about that. So like we suspect this kid has EOE, some inflammatory process, but there's also this narrowing.
Right.
What do you think?
Sure. So taking a step back. So I'm using a scope. So it's likely either it's an 8.8 or a 9.2. Mm-hmm. It's about 9 millimeters. And if you can appreciate narrowing with a 9 millimeter scope, some, is this a 10 millimeter narrowing? It's if it's 15, you're probably not going to see it. If it's 13, you're probably not going to see it. So this is probably going to be symptomatic, you know, for how old is he again?
14.
Oh, yeah. So is a person whose esophagus should be, you know, bigger than 14, right? So one of the things you could do is You're seeing him in the clinic. So what I'd probably do first is to do an esophagram. And I really want to get a good look at it. You don't have to. You can go right to endoscopy, but they just had an endoscopy.
Yeah.
So I think really looking at, so you can get a look and see how distensible it is, at least from a non-invasive standpoint. And then you can do a distensibility test. You know, mm-hmm. if you have the access, you can do an endoflip. And, you know, just to access the real-time luminal distensibility and functional diameter, you know, offering some information about the functional impact. And flip can be used during the scope. So you can do it before dilation and after dilation to both guide your dilation and assess the response to the dilation.
Yeah. We've been using EndoFlip more and more mm-hmm. for, you know, in the motility world and also, right. you know, when it comes to strictures. And I do think it's a very helpful tool to have for someone like this. I mean, if it's like a pretty clear stricture seen yes. endoscopically confirmed with like an esophagram,
yeah.
are there ever times when you think medical therapy would make that open up?
My
more,
practice or? Is mostly medical therapy.
Yeah. yeah. Okay.
Because they tend to get better.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And depending where you're starting, are you doing food elimination? Are you doing PPI? Are you doing steroids? Are you doing combination? Are you a 6-food elimination diet? And now, you know, with Dupixent, I mean, there, yeah, it's just right. a whole nother level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had a good friend in California and she's like, Michael, I've been telling her about Dupixent for you. She's had EoE since she was a little girl and she's in her mid-30s. And she, EoE, eczema, asthma. And she went to her GI. They didn't know anything about it. It's about a year or two ago. And then she went to an allergy. She called me. She's like, OMG, this has changed my world. Wow. You know, because she can eat now.
Yeah.
And she can eat. And her eczema, her asthma, she had, you know, affected both the skin and the skin within. She's had her yeah. irritable bowel syndrome so much better. She's like, Michael, I'm going to quit my job and go work for this. Because it's the quality of life issue. You know, yeah, it's a sure. morbidity issue. And so I think the medical therapy is so good that often, unless they're symptomatic after medical therapy is right. when I consider dilation. If you were going to consider dilation, you know, what would you consider? So would you do a mechanical dilation like bougie? You know, that's where you gradually introduced through the mouth. And, you know, the advantages are precise control over the dilation. The disadvantages can be blind unless you go over a wire. And there's both a shearing force as well as a radial force. And so you can a little more likely to get a tear versus direct visualization. You can do balloon dilation where you can stick a balloon through, you can use a guide wire. And the advantage is that it reduces risk of perforation because you know where you're going. Yeah. You're not going through a false track. And pressure can be adjusted as needed. Disadvantage is that, you know, they come in blocks. You know, it's, you know, whether you're doing a 6, 7, 8, 8, 9, 10, and then 10, 11, 12, then 12, 13, you know, so as you go up, it breaks it up. Fortunately, we're able to. So for example, when we see little ones that have a pinhole structure,
yeah.
our smallest balloon, they make 4-millimeter balloons. We have 6 in stock. And so it's 3 atmospheres. So I'll say, go to 1 atmosphere.
Yeah.
Or to 2 atmospheres. That's probably 2.5 millimeters. That's probably 3.5 to 4, you know, and then slowly work up. So I'll get a bigger balloon, but just go at lower volumes. It's not as precise, but it's visual control. And I like it a little bit better than the balloons. But for this patient, again, you'd want to, you know, is this a complex? Is this a simple stricture? What's mm-hmm. the length? You know, because it'll help predict is how many am I going to need? In my clinical practice is that most of the patients get a lot better afterwards. And if they don't, then, you know, if we maximize medical therapy, you know, guys, that's what would you want to do for your own child, right?
Right.
The least invasive to the most invasive. Then consider, but fortunately with medical therapy, I haven't had to dilate as much as in previous. So
that's pretty great. I mean, I want to talk specifically about size.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, the normal size of an esophagus of about a 14-year-old. Say we go in and we have a very small stricture in a 14-year-old boy. What is your practice as far as your starting point to when you stop?
Right.
And what would the goal be? Like, can you do like a full dilation on the very first time or do you need to bring them back?
Right. It depends. So it used to be you dilate a few millimeters above, but technically when you're in there, you can get a good sense. So sometimes they're just a little bit of fibrosis. And once you pop it open, well, then you can dilate quite a bit. And 14 doesn't have to be. In a 14-year-old, you could probably go to 18, depending on the rest of the lumen. Because once you dilate the balloon, you'll see if you and I'll sort of go through the process. You know, first you start out, how big is the stricture? So if the stricture allows passage of the scope, Then you get a good sense. Well, it's 9 millimeters, or if you're using the neonatal scope, it's 6 millimeters. Generally go past the scope and then pull the balloon into position. And you can use fluoroscopy or no fly. I was trained without fluoroscopy, but I use a lot of fluoroscopy now. The benefit is low fluoroscopic exposure. I am a low fluoroscopy guy, so I'll go low dose, intermittent. When I do ERCPs, my goal is that what's the least amount? Can I do 8 seconds of fluoro? You know, milligray, you know, of fluoro exposure, both for me, the staff, but also for the patients, because we don't know what the minimum amount of safe radiation exposure is. And a child who's growing, undergoing DNA repair, we just don't know, and less is more. And so generally, we pull back the balloon into this, a bit based on how big the scope is, if you happen to do an esophagram, and then we have a better idea of how large it is. And then you put the balloon in place, generally leave it in for a minute, although shorter duration may be acceptable. You can go up to 2 minutes. And the goal is to get a change in the luminal diameter. So if you're using fluoroscopy, you generally see a waste. And you go up and go up and use it, pop. You know, and then it'll advance. Subtle techniques that I'll use is, can I move the balloon in and out? And if you can move it in and out, then you have a little more room to grow. You want that Goldilocks just right. If you're moving the balloon and all the tissue, it's just so snug that the tissue moves, you're good, right? You know, we don't want to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. We want to come back and play another day. And so we'll get it. Yeah, but a recent study showed that dilating 5 millimeters above the initial stricture diameter did not increase perforation risk. So if you're at 8, you know, you could go to 13. 13.5 comes in a common size. Again, but I would typically go until when I move the balloon, it's moving tissue. We're good. And then take a look. Is it an inflammatory stricture? Especially with our esophageal tregear kids, we'll do intralesional steroids. We had a kid with duodenal atresia, partial duodenal atresia, diagnosed as 14, 15 months of age. And so we started doing dilations. We sent, and it was a pinhole. And we went to, 12 and then 16, did incisional therapy, and it was really responding nicely, outpatient. It brought him in, sent him home. And then the last one, we thought, I wonder what happens if you put steroids in there too. And so we did, and it was the pandemic, and the parents are like, this kid eats everything. He'd never eaten solids because he couldn't get through. Yeah. So now he's eating everything. We said, hey, can you come back? No, we're good. I was like, oh, can we just get an upper GI? No, we're good. We don't care. So we published the case in JPGN reports. But we couldn't get follow-up because the parents were like, he's fine. We don't want to do any more because – so that was remarkable. Did it help? If you did a follow-up imaging study, you may be able to help. But intuitively, chronic inflammation, can help slow down. So this looks like an inflammatory, especially if there's a lot of damage, trying to prevent that from scarring back down again.
No, I was going to say, I think you brought up, and it was an interesting comment that you made with that, because you said it was all outpatient. So I will never forget the first dilation that I did as a fellow, because I was actually kind of scared. It was I remember it was just a little bit smaller than the scope. And then I pushed the scope and it just, boop, it did the pop thing that you mentioned. And then there was that, always reminds me of Ice Age, where they have that little crack. Acorn and they put it in and it's like, whoop.
Yes.
So that was actually really scary for me. It's a scary thing to see. And so, but you mentioned in your situation that you did that as an outpatient. Are there situations when you see that rent or that type of change after you have the dilation that you leave the patient in the hospital afterwards, or do you send them home?
Essentially, we'll take a look and we'll say, oh, that's deep. If you're in the muscularis, because there's no serosal surface of the esophagus, so a higher risk of perforation. So if we have fluoroscopy handy, I'll do a completion esophagram to see if there are any leaks. If not, sometimes I'll get an x-ray in the PACU. And if your spidey sense says, I'm not feeling so good about this, we'll just admit overnight
just
for observations. Exactly. And one of the ways to minimize the risk of perforation is to begin with a diameter expected to be just a little bit smaller than the stricture. So the more you prepare beforehand, you'll have an idea. Is this going to be a 7? Is this going to be a 9? Is this going to be a pinhole? Then you can prepare accordingly and have all your equipment ready.
Yeah. I think that's a big advantage of EndoFLIP is you can measure it. So you know where to start.
And you can measure it before and after, especially with this, with an EOE patient, you can say, wow, we're really good at good results.
Yeah. And then so you briefly mentioned before, using a bougie dilator. Yeah. And So that's not something that I've ever used. You know, we have other people in our group that use them. So, but what would make you want to use a bougie dilator versus a balloon?
Balloons work so well. It used to be smaller patients, but even in our babies under 6 months of age, what we've done now is we'll use the neonatal scope. We have a 5.9 millimeter and we have a smaller scope. We have a 4.9 millimeter. Wow. It's a bit, it doesn't have a small wheel. So you have to, you know, do right to left control.
To turn,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, but we'll dilate and we'll put the balloon alongside.
Interesting.
So it takes, it's like playing video games. It takes a little bit of skill. And sometimes we have to put a guide wire in first, pull it out and then over it. But, takes a little more time. So we try to get it alongside with a little bit of wire sticking out. And if there's anything, then we'll just scoot the guide wire. But it's easier to dilate through the scope because you really have the up and down deflection to help guide the stuff. But with time, jaw thrust is really key. So I think that's a real pro tip. If you're doing supine endoscopy of any type, because oftentimes it's hard to get around the posterior pharynx. And I've had some very high, narrow pinhole strictures right proximally. And you just can't get in. So you need really constant jaw thrust to get around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for the majority of cases, scope balloon dilator should be enough.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. If you've had experience and they work, but if you haven't, then.
Right.
Yeah. If you're comfortable with balloon dilation and with it, and the studies show either with or without fluoroscopy.
Yeah.
Complicated strictures, it makes sense to have a little additional information, especially a completion esophagram to know that you haven't perforated.
Yeah.
They have a long drive and stuff.
I mean, I think in my mind, I had kind of thought that maybe a mechanical bougie dilator would be potentially more useful for like a diffusely narrow esophagus. Yes. Is there any truth to that?
It depends how long it is. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
It's just narrow all the way through.
Yeah.
100%. Yep. So if it's a long, especially a caustic ingestion, that's where it can be. So that's a great point. Because the balloons are only so many millimeters long.
Right,
so if you can't, then can that be very helpful?
Yeah.
But then, okay, so if you have a stricture longer than the balloon, would you just dilate and move the balloon, dilate and move the balloon, or would you prefer a bougie in that situation?
It depends, you know, based on your regional expertise and, you know, and comfort level. What are you comfortable doing, you know? And do you want to try something new on a very complicated stricture? So that some point, you know, especially as the complexity rises, at some point you say, boy, I'm might have someone do this who has just either a little more experience. Yeah.
I'm going to call Mike.
Yeah. Because you want that to have a great outcome, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And then also, too, if you have an esophageal airway treatment program or a team to be involved, because that's one who's high on the radar. If that's a bad, complicated stricture, hopefully you can do endoscopic therapy. But if not, they're going to need a big surgery. You know, and either, you know, a complicated surgery or even a jejunal interposition, you know, if we can't salvage the esophagus, if it's badly burned and scarred from a terrible, you know, caustic ingestion.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe one last thing before we move on to the next case. You mentioned like, there are times when you may have to repeat a dilation. What would make you think about maybe scheduling a repeat dilation versus waiting for symptoms? Does that ever happen where you're going to need another one? We need to just get on the books.
Complicated strictures generally require more than three dilations.
Yeah, okay.
So for example, in our area, a patient who's had an anastomosis, you know, we'll schedule a follow-up in a couple of weeks. And then, and sometimes if it's real tight, if it's a pinhole stricture, we'll schedule three in a weekly dilations, three in a row. Yeah, to see if it's going to be responsive.
Yeah.
And if it starts to respond, then we'll continue. You know, once you get to seven, then you're like, gosh, is this just a refractory stricture? Then you're considering, you know, putting in stents and other things. Usually by that time, our protocol is to start steroids by the second. But a couple of them, if they've worked really inflammatory, we'll do intralesional steroids after dilation right at the beginning.
Okay.
But generally, you know, after the first one, you'll do it after a week or two, and then you can do it every 3 or 4 weeks, depending on, you know, if it's complex or a simple stricture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. Okay. So now I want to specifically talk more about ingestion.
Yes.
So third case, 2-year-old boy, which they like to put everything in their mouth, rushed to the emergency room after swallowing a mothball. He developed respiratory distress, drooling, vomiting. They were able to remove the mothball after stay in the PICU, and he was discharged home without them even calling GI. 2 weeks later, he started having difficulty swallowing solids, and we find a stricture.
Although I think you guys because this is okay. This is based on a case report that Dr. Woolsey published. But you guys took out the mothball, right?
It was. I think
I was like, they did call GI because he wrote it up.
Yeah, Sarah Carju, this is her patient, and she helped her out with the dilation, you know, because it became a complex stricture, right? And so, you know, typically with caustic ingestions, they lead to esophageal injury ranging from just mild redness, erythema, sometimes ulcers, necrosis, you know, and often strictures, particularly circumferential. Severity depends on the substance, whether it's acid or an alkaline based, the concentration and duration of exposure. Acids typically cause coagulative necrosis and they taste bad. So oftentimes they're located in the mouth. Rarely do they affect the stomach and the lower esophagus. Alkalis, a little less noxious, and so you often get liquefactive necrosis. Deeper injury leads to saponification and actually, you know, significant damage. Strictures develop weeks to months after the initial injury. And in this case, you know, mothballs, that toxicity profile includes neurologic symptoms, skin damage, with GI effects being less well documented. But so we're not sure if there was a pressure sensation, whether there was a chemical reaction, but definitely developed a stricture.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about that? Because typically with a caustic ingestion, there is a time frame that you wait before you do your initial endoscopy. But if you have a patient who is drooling and they swallowed this like solid.
So they have a foreign body in there.
Yeah, so it's a foreign body. So did you go in right away? Sorry, I didn't read the case. I should have.
It's all right.
So Dr. Carju removed it and it looked okay. But with time, you know, it scarred down. So if there is a circumferential injury, you know, then you're a little more concerned, like, gosh, do we need to protect that airway? And put down a nasogastric tube and to maintain. But apparently it didn't look like that. But and again, it's possible in this case the stricture formed due to toxic inflammatory response due to either the chemical itself or the compression, the physical presence of the mothball causing irritation and fibrosis during the healing response. And so it had a delayed stricture.
I mean, are there things that can be done to prevent stricture formation, or really it's like, you know, once we evaluate the mucosa, you know, it's kind of just waiting with time.
So generally recommendations are after an injury, if you go in too soon, you know, 12 hours, 24 hours, you know, it's hard to assess the damage, you know, to get an after action report. Yeah. Like how bad is it? Right. So we want to know what the details are. So generally in the first 48 to 72 hours to assess the extent of injury and really to help guide treatment. Steroids are controversial. Antibiotics are controversial. PPIs may reduce, you know, gastric acid secretion, prevent further damage. Nutritional support.
Yeah.
You know, if it's circumferential or concerned for, we had a bad butt injury probably about 3 weeks ago. Fortunately, it was not circumferential. But really, the burn went deep into the muscularis. Mm. And I did the follow-up scope after, I think we were about 72 hours, the second follow-up.
Oh.
It was better, but it, when you look at it, you're like, oh, my goodness. Mm. But fortunately, it was healing. The necrosis had fled off, and there was a lot of granulation tissue. But it was deep, deep ulcer. But the patient was able to eat and did not perf and was able to go home. CT, of course, you really want to image the surrounding vessels, you know, aortic fistula. Yeah. Just it makes it keeps everybody up at night. You know, is it going to be early? Is it late? And it's not clear when the timing is. When we have the patient, that's typically when we do the CT. We just want to know how close it is. Is this millimeters? Do we need to call the CT surgeon when we're pulling this out, or is it a longer distance and a little less stress provoking from that standpoint? And really for these kids, because they're not eating, you know, nutritional support. So whether we're feeding an NG tube, you know, we need to promote healing.
And like, you know, so we talked about methods of dilation and, you know, you also mentioned, like steroid injection, like in this case, I think the case report described that you did inject kind of that at the first scope. What makes you want to do that in the beginning versus like, oh, it's refractory to balloon dilation alone, we do it later?
So that's a great question. And really looking at, is this an inflammatory, is this, you know, hot mess? You know, would adding steroids cool things down a little bit?
Yeah.
If untreated, well, this residual inflammation that's there, is that going to lead to, you know, because inflammation, unrelenting, uncontrolled inflammation leads to fibrosis, leads to scarring, you know, and scars tissue shrinks. If it's circumferential, it's going to cause a stricture. So the degree of scarring, of inflammation, you know, is it circumferential? I think those play a role. And I think we were proactive with this one because wasn't expecting a stricture.
Right.
And then we dilated it and I think we had a pretty good result, but we didn't want that fresh tear the good tear, right? the Goldilocks, to then scar back down again. So we injected steroids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you ever use like mitomycin C or stents?
Yeah. So we use stents. Mitomycin C has been, a lot of I've talked to providers and they really, it seems to, they've had good experience with it. You know, the pediatric literature, there's some conflicting reports. A couple studies show, well, it doesn't seem to help. There was a meta-analysis of what's out there that says it does help. You know, but while promising, it requires further studies, really some prospective study, some randomized trials to really get a good sense of how effective it could be. But my experience is that I haven't used it very much, but essentially you get a pledgelet, mm-hmm. 2x2 LEs, and then you put a mitomycin C. Ideally, you have a cap. We were talking about that earlier because you don't want to drag it through the mouth and the esophagus, right? And so you have a cap to protect it, and then you put it on. Is it for 30 seconds? Is it a little bit longer? You're trying to prevent this inflammatory response. But I've talked to people who have used it. It seems steroid injection is like sclerotherapy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's often part of our training. So we get a lot of training with sclerotherapy. It's like needle out, inject. It's 1 to 2 per kilo. Comes in 4 milligrams. You know, so I'll either get 4, 8, or 12, or 16. Max dose of 40. Especially for a one-time dose. If you do repeated steroid use, you have to think about adrenal suppression, or if you overshoot the mark, right, then you can have a higher risk of adrenal suppression. You know, but a 1 to 2, and I'll just round up a little bit, and you just 4 quadrants. Okay. And really, it's counterintuitive because you just made a tear and then you want to inject into the tear. But just like sclerotherapy, right? Uh-huh. When you put the needle in, don't go left, don't go right, you know, don't tear that thing open. Same thing with nitrogen, inject it, because you want to get into the mucosa and the muscularis area to have some local steroid and do 4 quadrants. It's pretty quick, usually less than a minute or so to inject it. It's like squirt, 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 squirt.
Yeah. And then how about stents? Like, how is that a... When do you use
stents
those?
Are a little more cumbersome. They make esophageal stents, but not for kids, babies. And so we do ERCP, so we have fully covered metal stents. And so we'll use whether it's an 8 or a 10 millimeter stent, depending on the size. So if you've got a refractory 7 or 6 millimeter, and you can apply, and it's what happens is when you deploy it, it foreshortens. Because it's like it's a long straw, and then when it shortens, and it has two ends. And so you do it under fluoroscopy. And so you'll start to open. You're like, nope, too much. And you get to the point of no return. Same with like hemoclips and everything, mm-hmm. where you just have to deploy. You can have symptoms. So symptoms, if you leave it in too long for more than a few weeks, the flange edges can rub in. So we've seen some ulcers distally. If it's too high, it'll tickle the back of the kids will have retching. So I've had little ones who tolerated well. I had one guy who tolerated first time he did and the second time he didn't, because it was just tickling the back of his throat. And so that, and then also if it's not, again, really balanced, if it's, you have too much stent distally, it's going to migrate out. And then you pull out. So fortunately, it's relatively easy to pull out of the stomach. So it's a bridge and it's a tool. It's not an end all be all, but the one thought is before considering surgery, give it a shot and see.
And
there are so many people you can call, you know, that say, hey, you know, Mike Manfredi and Diana Lerner and Ken Ng. And there's so many advanced endoscopists that whoever your local is, say, hey, what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah.
If you don't feel comfortable, it's like, hey, what do you think about seeing this patient?
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I bother Muhammad all the time. Indeed. Every day walking past his office, going home to the parking garage. Right,
yeah. So good.
Like, hey, what are you doing right now? Nothing? Okay.
How's your schedule, Muhammad?
Oh, man.
So like with temporary stenting, can be used in severe refractory strictures, unresponsive to dilation alone. You know, it just keeps the esophagus open, allowing ingested materials to pass while the tissue heals. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're having trouble swallowing, you can put an NG tube down so you can feed through the stent. Yeah, especially in young children complicated by feeding difficulties. But like we said, you know, finding an appropriately sized stent. So we have some biliary ones. Sometimes we'll go to the OR and there's tracheal stents that you can use, but there's a risk of migration, potential tissue overgrowth. Really, stenting's reserved for refractory cases, that you're just as a bridge or a possible diversion to before surgery.
So tissue overgrowth. That sounds like it'd be bad. Removal would be messy.
Messy, indeed. Oh, it's granulation tissue, right? Yeah, it's growth. So, and this fully covered except for the ends of the flanges. So sometimes if it just rubs and rubs and rubs and rubs, yeah, and the tissue goes through and you pull it out and it's a little bloody, it's kind of messy, but it's superficial.
Yeah. Right. So right. Okay. Well, anyways, but that was so good. Wow. We covered so much stuff. That
I mean, awesome. I think it was great because we went through like the congenital potential post-op strictures. We talked about EOE and food impactions and the use of some new technology, as well as caustic ingestions of multiple kinds. Just so much good information here.
So no pressure, but give us your three takeaways this discussion.
As Jen, she summarized well. You know, the other thing, too, is prognostication. Is this a simple stricture or is this a complicated stricture? So I think it's really cause-specific management. Treating the treatment of esophageal stricture varies with the underlying cause and emphasizing the importance of accurate diagnosis and get as much information as you can before you go in and start doing therapy. I think the second one is prompt treatment and follow-up. You know, if you've got something, especially caustic strictures, you know, put an NG tube in if you need to start dilating, you know, once therapy allows. Because early intervention can prevent complications. And ongoing monitoring is crucial to identify and manage stricture recurrence. And I think the last that we talked a little bit about is just prevention and education. You know, patient family education about the dangers of, say, caustic ingestion of mothballs, of, you know, batteries. And for those that have chronic conditions, you know, adherence to medical treatment for eosinophilic esophagitis and even GERD, you know, for patients that to try to prevent recurrence of stricture.
Love it.
Love it. Okay, so looking back on your career, what is the most valuable advice you've received, and what advice do you have for us and our listeners?
So many. There's so many advice I've received, but I was thinking about, I was sharing actually earlier this morning, you know, some of the best advice one of my mentors when I was at Texas Children's, she said, Michael, there is no perfect job out there. And she taught me about the Pareto principle. Vilfredo Pareto was an Italian economist who, in the 1800s, he observed that 80% of the land was owned by 20% of the landowners. You know, it's called the 80-20 rule. You know, if you look in business and real estate, you know, 20% of the realtors sell 80% of the homes. And that 80% of the joy and happiness comes from 20% of the work that I do. You know, night call, weekends, holidays, insurance overrides, you know, you know, that's not what I love about medicine, but there's 20% that is just phenomenal. You know, being of service, taking care of others, connecting, working as a team. You know, can I focus on that 20%? Because that's where my joy and happiness is. The others is mandatory. And so the other thing too, I try to gamify things. Like if I'm doing parent callbacks, I'll time them. Like,
yes,
that was 3 minutes. Oh, that was 2.5. That was 8. And I'll say, Wilson, you were being pretty chatty. Let's see if you can get down to it. Signing charts. I will time myself. Yeah. How many can I do? How many 10 charts can I sign and update? And how long does it take? Doing notes when I'm rounding and weekends. You know, we usually have a practitioner assistants, but often we'll do notes as well. And I'll just time myself and just make it fun.
Yeah.
Because it's a necessary that I have to do. Mm-hmm. Why not have squeeze out as much fun possible doing the things that may not be intuitively fun? So timing myself really seems to help.
Honestly, I thought I was the only one who did that.
You time yourself too?
If I have a long list of notes to write, I'm like, yeah, I time myself. I try to like total calculate my average and how can I get
because
it down?
Then there's an improvement. That which can be measured can be managed.
Yeah.
Right? It's a sound principle. And so can I get a little bit better? Can I get a little faster? And then I get more efficient at the necessary workload that's needed to be able to practice medicine at a high level.
And like, so then if I know, okay, I think it's going to be 10 minutes till my procedure, I know I can finish the X number of notes in that 10 minutes.
100%.
I don't just like, oh, I can't get anything done in 10 minutes.
It, you know? It lowers the resistance.
Yeah.
I belong to a men's group. And so we talk about how easy would it be if you wanted to do it?
Yeah.
Right? Because if I don't want to do something, there's only one reason. There's only one reason I don't want to do it. Because I've decided I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
What about
it's not fun.
What if I change my mind? You know? Because I don't have my problem with my own conception of anything. So how easy would it be if you wanted to do those notes? Mm-hmm. If you wanted to do that discharge summary? You know, change your mind, change your life. And we just have to change our perspective.
Oh, man.
Man.
We need another episode with you.
Motivational.
Just on
motivating us. I actually want to go for a run with you, but I'm probably way slow.
Easy running. It's so great.
Yeah.
So, oh man. But thank you so much for joining us. That was incredible.
That was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
We got to do this again.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
So fun. I mean, and so much great information, such good mentorship advice. I can see why I could just feel the joy of teaching and mentoring and the joy that you have in taking care of your patients. It's very inspiring.
I think that's for all of us, is finding out what's our jam.
Yeah.
You know, what do I love? Can I just do more of that?
Yeah.
You know, and the others, can I get someone on my team who's better at the things that I don't like as much?
Yeah.
You know, and that way just enjoy what we do. Okay.
Yeah.
Off track, so.
Yeah, that's all right. All right.
But thank you so
that
much.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, super
that was
fun.
Really great.
Great episode.
So good.
Another one.
Yeah. I mean, he's just like obviously so knowledgeable and a great role model, I think, for many of us who are more junior. And like the life philosophies, you know?
I know. That's I think the running thing is really great. Maybe we should all go running with him at NASPGN this year on the beach.
No, no.
It's going to be great. Let's do it.
Is that 5K thing still happen?
I have no idea. Okay. Yeah. If you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BowelSounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes.
If you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us out if you did one or all of the following three things. One, tell one person about the podcast. Two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover our podcast. And three, on our Buzzsprout page is a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.naspghan.org. The money you donate helps support some of the amazing things the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
As always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the host and guest and are subject to change with advances in the field. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.